Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 28. The next morning when the phone rang and awakened me, I let it ring until it stopped, then took the receiver off the hook. I felt a lot like I did the day after Bob died, overwhelmed by a crushing sense of innocence lost. When Jason attacked me, I lost every illusion I maintained about the inherent goodness of the human-canine bond. In that instant, I knew that if I didn't hold Elizabeth and Teresa close to me, let them lick my tears and feel and smell their doggy presence, I'd never trust them, or any dog, again. Even more numbing was the realization that, when I summoned the wherewithal to kill Jason, I'd awakened a previously unacknowledged part of myself that it would take me a long time to learn to trust too. Virtually every cell in my body protested when I finally got up enough energy to drag myself off the couch. I stumbled into the downstairs bathroom and stood in a hot shower until I felt woozy, then staggered to the kitchen, washed down some antibiotics and painkillers with a glass of orange juice, and fell asleep on the couch with Maddie and the dogs again. I repeated the sequence two more times before making it up the stairs and falling into bed that evening, staying awake only long enough to invite Teresa, who I usually banned from the bed for snoring and shedding, to join me and the other pets. I wanted, no, needed, all the animal companionship I could get. Sometime later the phone rang. A superb reminder that I must have automatically replaced the receiver before coming upstairs. I groaned and rolled over, causing both dogs to grumble and wake me even more. I grumbled right along with them, trying to free up enough of the comforter trapped beneath the three furry bodies to pull over my head. As I did, the words, "Answer the bloody phone," unaccountably occurred to me. Without thinking, I picked up the bloody bedside phone and mumbled, "What do you want, McCarthy?" The silence that initially greeted me made me wonder if I'd roused myself for an obscene caller. But then a familiar voice proclaimed, "You're up." "Yeah, I had to get up to answer the phone," I yawned sleepily. "I thought I owed you an explanation," he volunteered, an enticing offer that most effectively penetrated the grumpy fog enveloping me. "I'd love to hear it," I encouraged him not quite so grumpily, thinking he'd called to satisfy my curiosity about his fuzzy background, among a lot of other fuzzy details I felt needed defuzzing. "About what I was doing at Journey's End," he added, a mere fraction of what I had in mind, but I accepted it in hopes it might lead to more. "Both times?" I prompted him just in case he harbored any thoughts about not giving me the whole scoop about what little he seemed willing to tell me. Another borderline obscene lull followed, during which I noticed that it was downright cold sitting up in my bed opposite the open window through which an unseasonably cool breeze blew. "The first time I went for two reasons," he finally admitted. "To see if Hal stole the goat and the data." I shared my latest personal theory as I hugged myself to keep warm. "That's all part of the first reason," he corrected me. "The second was because Ted DeWitt wanted me to make sure the house was secure if Hal hadn't stolen them." Pleased that he'd actually given me an answer that sounded legitimate, I pressed forward with my inquiry, while simultaneously attempting to yank more of the comforter from under Teresa, the largest and most resistant fur-bearing obstacle. "Why did Ted DeWitt care if the house was secure?" I hoped McCarthy couldn't hear Teresa's pathetic whimpering when I finally succeeded in dislodging her. because he'd suspected Hal was taking confidential reports right along, but didn't know why and couldn't prove it, came McCarthy's response. Over time, when nothing came of it, he assumed Hal took them home to study and let it go because he felt sorry for him and knew his home was secure. But he wasn't so sure about the lake house. A legitimate fear, I laughed and ignored the old husky staring morosely at me as I wrapped myself in my hard-won prize. Is breaking and entering part of your basic biomedical consulting service? Or is that an add-on you picked up from some of your many friends in the law enforcement community? McCarthy treated me to another obscene pause, during which Teresa slowly inched toward the hem of the comforter that I'd firmly tacked down with my toes. I consider it an add-on, he eventually answered. This particular case had several of them. Care to hear about some of the others? I envisioned the highly suggestive look in his very blue eyes so vividly, I blushed and quickly changed the subject. Did Hal have anything to do with the missing goat? I asked to cover my embarrassment and distract myself from the tingling sensation created by a long-absence, dangerously seductive current singing through my body. Not a thing, came the immediate reply that barely concealed a very masculine chuckle, practically dripping with testosterone. He just happened to take the report the same day Weintraub stole the goat that went with it. Did Hal know what happened to the report? I posed the question in what I considered an absolutely asexual, professional tone in an effort to get his, and my own, mind on safer subjects. He forgot all about it until the night you and I broke in, he reported. Matching my sexless tone so perfectly, I knew I hadn't fooled him at all. Then he thought you and I, or rather a whole gang of industrial thieves, had stolen it. That's why he didn't call the police. Because then he would have had to explain how he came to have it in the first place? I postulated, then slapped my hand over the mouthpiece when Teresa let out a particularly lewd groan when her efforts to burrow under the comforter failed. My caller acknowledged the correctness of my hypothesis, then added, "What was that noise?" Believe me, McCarthy, you don't want to know. I quickly mounted the comforter on top of the dog to muffle the sound. So Hal didn't know that Pamela had burned the report? No, he assured me with certainty, then became pensive. For reasons we'll never know, she never told him. My own speculations about what motivated someone like Pamela Winthrop automatically took me to my final encounter with the troubled young woman. Why did you go to Journey's End the second time? I asked, when the memory of him gently removing my hand from Pamela's, then wrapping his arms around me, filled my mind. It was pretty clear from what you told Doug that you'd learned something that incriminated one of the other dogs, he reported not quite neutrally. When he told me about that chisel of yours, I was afraid you were going to try some breaking and entering again. This time he treated me to one of his, "You're supposed to say something remorseful here," pauses. Oh, I said instead, "I imagine you would have taken great joy in turning me in." On the contrary, he probably said just to be contrary, I'd seen Pamela's car at the general store on my way to Doug's and wanted to warn you if that's where you'd gone. Unfortunately, by the time I got there... His voice trailed off and another long interval followed, during which I had no difficulty imagining him trying to decide whether to finish that sentence, while I struggled to fight off a yawn. Are you sure you're going to be all right, Dr. Upton? The amount of concern in his voice caught me by surprise. Trust me, Dr. McCarthy, I smiled, forgetting all about the yawn. I'm going to be just fine. Yet another silence greeted my comments, this one so long I decided it must take him days to give a single lecture. I was about to ask him how long it did take him when he cleared his throat. One last thing. Yes, McCarthy? I'd bake those cookies a little longer, if I were you. I'm sure I was still laughing when I fell asleep a short time later, curled around Elizabeth for warmth, while Teresa snored happily beneath the comforter. While walking down the driveway to my mailbox several days later, I noticed that the large bruises on my arm and leg were evolving nicely from bluish-purple to greenish-yellow. That pleased me greatly, but then I found I took pleasure in many things that had escaped my notice since Bob's death. In my mailbox, I found a large stack of mail and, on top of it, a thick envelope from Hanover College. Inside the envelope, a personal letter from Hanover's president asked me to consider applying for a Wentworth Fellowship. Application enclosed. Fat chance. I put the envelope on the bottom of the pile. As I walked back up the hill, I continued leafing through my mail. Next, reprints of some articles sent by a colleague captured my attention, and I sat down on a stone wall in front of the house to read them. As I did, a familiar vehicle came up the driveway and eased to a stop on the level blue stone expanse in front of me. "I brought your crisper." Douglas DeWitt sheepishly hailed me with a missing object as he walked toward me. "You?" I vacillated between disbelief and curiosity. "But how did you know about the samples?" "I saw you at Monica's picking stuff up from the ground and was afraid it was something that would incriminate my dog. There was a clear view of her cottage from mine." He said the latter as if he told me something I already knew, even though the idea that he'd seen me had never crossed my mind. "When I saw your car over there again later, I decided to come here to see if I could find out what you took. Sorry about shutting your dogs in the bedroom, but the little one kept wanting to play." He smiled apologetically and handed me the crisper. "How did you know where I lived?" I watched Elizabeth and Teresa sniffing his car in an attempt to pick up clues regarding the identities of its two canine occupants. "I had your business card, remember?" He grinned shyly when he reminded me of that fact. I searched everywhere before it dawned on me that the best place for any samples was in the refrigerator. But just when I found them, you came home. Scared me to death. "What did you do with them?" I was envisioning him analyzing them in his lab at TransGen when he answered the question. "I threw them into the woods on my way back to the cottage," came the unexpected reply. "But why? Why go to all the trouble of stealing them, only to throw them away?" He momentarily shut his eyes and drew in a deep breath before answering. "As soon as I saw those droppings, I knew Monica was somehow mixed up with Dad's missing goat. I didn't want to know that, and I didn't want anyone else to know it either." He took another deep breath and looked at me very soberly. "That's why I sent the threats after Dr. Fujama told me about your interest in what happened. I wanted to scare you enough that you dropped the whole thing." I solemnly looked at him and tried to remember what it felt like to be that young and innocent, and that much in love. I couldn't. "You bandaged my arm and covered me with a comforter?" I asked the question in a way I hope communicated that I wasn't at all angry with him. He shrugged in a self-conscious manner I found most appealing. "I stayed until I was sure you were okay. Mind if I let my dogs out?" The sudden change of subject made it very clear that Douglas DeWitt found his previous behavior embarrassing and wanted to terminate any discussion of the subject. Because lately I'd found myself involved in certain activities that left me feeling more than a little embarrassed myself, I readily agreed. He opened the door and released the Rottweiler and the Shepherd mix I'd seen at Journey's End. "This is Melville." He introduced a Rottweiler who now sported numerous healing puncture wounds in addition to his shaved ear. "Melville?" I looked from dog to owner in surprise. I thought his name was... Oh, never mind. Douglas DeWitt gave me a sweet, sensitive smile I knew meant he expected me to have a hot flash any minute. "And this is Maggie. Or maybe Trudy," he announced, twirling the other dog's ear affectionately. "I haven't decided on a name for her yet." "She's a new dog?" I proposed the obvious. "A stray I'm adopting. I'd seen her hanging around since I got here," he explained as the four dogs circled each other, making scent introductions. "But then when Chan mentioned you feeding her at Hal's, I figured someone must have dumped her. So I started putting food out for her." "How long have you had her?" I used a mundane question to distract myself from the awareness of how grossly I'd misinterpreted Douglas DeWitt and his bag of dog food. "Since the day after the storm," he reported, watching the canine quartet tentatively begin to play. "I tried to get her to come inside before it started to rain, but the thunder spooked her and she took off. Then when I went looking for her later, I saw her trailing someone down the road and thought it was her owner. But then she was back the next day, and wet and hungry enough, she let me coax her inside." The awareness that had fled into the lake and endured that agonizing walk home in an effort to escape nothing more threatening than a frightened, abandoned dog seeking food and companionship simultaneously relieved and appalled me. I was in the process of telling myself what adult I was when my visitor tied up another loose end. "Sorry about locking you out of your car, too," he grinned meekly. "I thought you were snooping around looking for Mel." "But McCarthy, he saw the keys when he stopped in after the storm and rimmed me out pretty good," he hesitantly interrupted me. "I think he was afraid that something had happened to you." I waved aside yet another raft of apologies and thought about McCarthy's presence in my kitchen that next morning, and his very strong coffee. It now seemed highly likely that he'd spent the night there, then recovered his normal bubbly good humor when I finally made my appearance the next morning. That probable truth caused such a legion of conflicting emotions to assault me, I turned my attention back to dogs again. "You going to continue with the Shih Tzu training?" I asked, but then regretted I did when I saw the pained expression that instantly aged the young man's boy's features. "I don't know." He nervously mounded up a sizable pile of crushed stone with the tip of his sneaker. I don't know how I feel about what happened." His voice broke, and I tactfully turned away to observe Maddie cautiously creeping toward the dogs while my visitor composed himself. "Why did you go to Journey's End?" I inquired quietly, when it seemed like he wanted to talk again. "I felt so helpless when Chan drove off. I took Mel and cut through the woods. I didn't want anything to happen to you either." "Doug, Mel's an exceptional dog." I touched his arm lightly, compelling him to look at me. "And you're an exceptional person." "I know that. About him, at least. But I don't know." Rather than returning my gaze, he stared blankly into space. "I don't know if I want a dog trained to decide on his own when to go after someone." "Is that what happened?" He mounded more stone with his sneaker before finally answering. "I don't know what happened." He kicked the pile so savagely, rocky projectiles shot off in all directions. "I saw Jason go after you, and Mel was on him in a flash. But I was so shocked by what was going on, I don't know if I gave the command or not." "But you did call him after he pinned Jason, didn't you?" I reminded him when it became clear where his thoughts led him. "And he did come." Douglas DeWitt readily gave an affirmative nod, but it took him a while to get out his next words. "But when Jason went after you again, Mel wanted to go, but I couldn't let him." His tortured expression further emphasized his tortured words. "Pam's arms were flailing, and I was afraid he'd go for them rather than Jason because of the training. Then your arm came over that chisel, and I was afraid it'd go after you. It all happened so fast. His voice broke again, and he stopped and stared at the remnants of the mound of stone at his feet. Do you trust him, Doug? I asked the question I knew plagued the sensitive young man, who once believed that his dog, his very best friend in the whole world, could do no wrong. He looked at me helplessly, and two tears ran down his cheeks. I intended to give him a quick reassuring hug, but wound up holding him for a very long time. Is it all right if I come up and talk to you about this some more? He asked when he finally pulled away. You tell me, and I'll be here. I promised, knowing that I needed to talk to him as much as he needed to talk to me. We set up a time, and then I gave him one last hug and sent him and his dogs on their way. Sometime later, I remained seated on the stone wall, mulling over a parting fact Douglas DeWitt had shared. Chandler McCarthy had been called back to England suddenly, several days earlier. Probably another of his good friends in dire need of clandestine biomedical consulting, I postulated to the cat. I spent no little time analyzing what I thought about that. Not McCarthy's friend's possible crisis, but the fact that he was gone. In the end, I decided I felt like a runner who tapped into hidden reserves just as a grueling race ended, relieved that it was over, at the same time as I wanted to see how much farther I could go. I sighed and turned my attention back to my mail and uncovered yet another envelope with a Hanover College return address amid the flyers. Inside this one, I found a glossy photo of myself wearing a hideously demented expression as I struggled to carry a clearly rebellious goat across McCarthy's tacky threshold. The back of the photo bore one sentence in his precise script. Lucky for you, I didn't have the detonator connected. The giggles erupted immediately and quickly escalated into raucous laughter when I envisioned McCarthy scrupulously rigging his hidden camera to glean some meticulous details for his new book and picking up the fruits of his labor at the local Photoshop or downloading them from his high-tech camera, only to discover the picture of me and the goat among those of himself carrying his clean laundry or greasy bags from his favorite Chinese restaurant into his humble abode. It was all I could do to muster the composure to summon the pets and retreat into the house. After sticking the photo on the refrigerator door to remind myself to do something about my hair, I went to pitch the junk mail. As I started to toss the Wentworth Fellowship application into the waste paper basket along with the flyers, though, Maddie wrapped his sleek, muscular body around my legs again and again. The big, sometimes killer cat looked up at me, and I looked down at him, and then at the document I held in my hand. No sooner did I slip the application into the center drawer of my desk for further consideration then the most outrageous idea popped into my head. I'd get a tattoo. An itty-bitty one. Somewhere where it wouldn't show. Perhaps a little cat. With wings. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.